This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Canadian government's been accused of muzzling its scientists. Delegates at a major science meeting said that communication of important research on environmental and health issues is being suppressed.
You just heard the BBC starting its report on how Canadian government scientists are often forbidden to speak to the press, even after publishing studies in major international journals. We'll hear three shocking cases explained by Canada's top science reporter, Margaret Munro. It's not just Canada. Here is NASA's top climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, speaking at a special presentation at the 2012 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science with moderator Frank Sesno.
Jim, I have a question for you from the audience. How can scientists navigate government instructions to keep quiet on issues such as climate change? How can scientists avoid letting themselves be muzzled?
It's easy but difficult because there are consequences. I mean,
you've experience with this?
Yeah, and it's a trade-off, you know. So, well, when I was being muzzled, I waited a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and let the events occur, so I had a track record to show that I had been prevented from being on NPR and had been prevented from talking to Los Angeles Times reporter.
And where was the muzzling coming from?
It was coming from public affairs at NASA headquarters, who had been called, NASA headquarters had been called by the White House. So it was fairly easy to then for me to inform New York Times, this is what's happening. And then it got on the front page of the New York Times. But there are consequences. As a result, shortly thereafter, the first line of the NASA mission statement to understand and protect our home planet disappeared. And the funding for Earth Science R&D was decreased retroactively 20% to the beginning of the fiscal year.
The right of experts to speak out has improved slightly in the United States since George Bush gave way to the Obama administration. Francesco Griffo of the Union of Concerned Scientists reveals how information important to your safety was suppressed by industry lobbyists. As the outgoing president of the AAAS, Dr. Nina Fedorov, told a press conference in Vancouver, belief systems, especially when tinged with fear, are not easily dispersed with facts. She said, as a result of a campaign of misinformation through the mainstream media and the net in America, quote, fewer people believe in climate change each year, end quote. Fedorov told reporters, quote, I'm scared to death because that obviously stalls what we need to be doing to adapt to climate change, end quote. She continued, quote, we are sliding back into a dark era, and there seems to be little we can do about it. I am profoundly depressed at just how difficult it has become merely to get a realistic conversation started on issues such as climate change or genetically modified organisms, end quote, from Nina Fedorov. That ends up with statements like this from Republican candidate Rick Santorum.
It's about some phony ideal. Some phony theology. Oh, not a theology based on the Bible, different theology.
I referred to global warming as not climate science, but political science.
We were put on this earth as creatures of God to have dominion over the earth, to use it wisely and steward it wisely, but for our benefit, not for the earth's benefit.
I've never supported even the hoax of global warming, the scientific hoax of global warming.
Santorum is just part of a race to the bottom, as all candidates deny global warming and often science in general, including evolution. But first, the fossil fuel industry has combined with some very wealthy ideologues to make you doubt global warming is happening or that we are facing big changes in the climate. For years, we guessed and partly knew that a small group of right-wing think tanks, weathermen and bloggers, and even a couple of low-grade climate scientists were being paid off. We just couldn't see through the corporate veil of deception. Now we know that many of the same people hired by the tobacco industry to create doubt that smoking killed millions of people found a new source of funding and a new cause attacking climate science and the scientists. Hidden money fueled a campaign of lies, innuendo, and fear-mongering. In our recent news, we finally got hard information on just who is paying for these attacks and how the money flows out of so-called independent experts and bloggers. A well-known scientist penetrated the secret funding sources for the climate attack's central place, an alleged charity called the Heartland Institute. Dr. Peter H. Gleick is co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security in Oakland, California. After receiving an anonymous strategy document thought to be from the Heartland Institute, Gleick added himself to a mailing list for Heartland directors. The documents emailed to him confirmed our worst suspicions. Wealthy philanthropists and fossil fuel companies were funding a network of climate denial, not just in the United States, but in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and possibly the UK. It was all tax-deductible, paid by American taxpayers. We didn't really need the Heartland emails leaked to dsmogblog.com. Another source, Dr. John Mashey, patiently analyzed public documents to track it all down. Let's talk with him now. Here is some friendly advice for climate deniers. Hope that Dr. John Mashey doesn't notice you. Last summer, Radio EcoShock ran a presentation by Dr. Mashey on his detailed investigation into the funding of the alleged institutes and self-proclaimed experts who say global warming doesn't exist and who promote the interests of fossil fuel companies. John Mashey is one of America's top computer experts with a history in Bell Labs and in Silicon Valley. Now he applies his skills outing those who attack climate science and scientists. Dr. Mashey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks a lot, Alex.
It's been a hot time for one of the worst offenders, the Heartland Institute. Is your new report based on the leaked internal documents showing their billionaire funders and intentions?
No, I had no connection with it, oddly. Certainly what appeared in that leak was not very much of a surprise to me, actually, because I had seen most of the sorts of things before. So, in fact, from my point of view, the timing was really not very good. I would have much preferred if somebody was going to do that they had waited a few weeks. So I, in fact, had capped off this 200-plus page report, had prepared a complaint to the IRS the night before, and then last Tuesday, all crazy chaos broke loose.
Right, indeed it did. And I took time to go through that 200-page outline about the front groups who attack climate science, and I found it, listeners, at dsmogblog.com. It seems incredible. Big corporations and wealthy family foundations put out propaganda through tax-deductible charity foundations. How do they do that?
Well, that's the interesting question, you see, is In fact, a lot of this dates back to the tobacco wars. And, of course, I go into that in some detail. I'm afraid that tobacco companies built machinery and tactics for confusing people about science. And they tried quite often to get that message out through every venue they could. And one batch of think tanks was perfectly happy to take their money for years. And fortunately, all that's recorded in the tobacco archives. One digs around and knows the right questions, you can find amazing history there. Thing is, they built this machinery, and then that same machinery has been applied to other things, like various environmental problems and including climate change. So sort of people got a lot of practice doing this, and then perhaps the tobacco money went down a little bit. There was something else to do.
And one of those tobacco guys who's now an anti-climate man is Fred Singer, and he's often listed as being from the University of Virginia. Why does that university put up with him?
Well, because he's actually an emeritus professor, and that title in some cases sticks forever. And in fact, he hasn't really been attached to the university, as far as I can tell, since around 1994. You know, some emeritus professors, I live just next to Stanford, and I know a lot of them, are very active, still working either in their own areas, or they maybe shift to a new career. There's a great Nobel Prize winner named Burton Richter who shifted from particle physics over into climate and energy and still contributes. But Fred's been long gone from Virginia. The trouble is, there's not much they can do if he, as long as he sticks the emeritus on his name, which he often doesn't.
And Fred Singer listed a dead man as the chair of his supposed charity. Is that right?
That is correct. For 2 years after Frederick Seitz was dead, he was listed in the official IRS forms, handwritten by Fred, the singer, as working an hour a week, which leads me to think, well, maybe Fred Singer has a good spirit medium or something. I'm not sure what. But I will say this, Seitz was listed as getting zero pay.
Well, talk to us about the Heartland Institute. Why don't we start with their efforts to push anti-science in the classrooms of the United States and in Canada?
Yes, well, that was actually one of the things in this that came up in this recent leak was this plan to build a curriculum, actually written by someone who's not a climate scientist, that would, you know, be able to be injected into the schools. And many people were really surprised at this. I wasn't, because I had read through 1,700 pages of their environment and climate newsletter, and they had a long history of trying to push these views into the schools, not very successfully, and they sort of alluded to that in the leaked funding report. So they've been doing this for years. They started with a campaign, is your child being indoctrinated or educated? The first one was a picture of a sweet young girl with some books. Apparently that didn't work so well, so they switched to a picture of Al Gore. Maybe that would stir people up. But even further back in 2002 or so, they were telling their readers, share articles from this with your child or even with your school teachers. So they review kids' books. You can guess they like some kids' books and they really dislike others. They had a series of videos they tried to put out. And if you go read my article called Faked Education at DSmog Blog, it's got a pointer to a 5-minute video trailer that is just, you know, a thing you must see.
Right, and I see from your charts, and it was echoed in the leaked documents, that the Heartland Institute received millions from a single anonymous donor. Do we have any clues who that is?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's pretty well in the blogs, and it is something I almost included, but I still had some work to do to track a few things down. The leaked information helped remove certain possibilities. I would suggest that there is huge amount of evidence that it's, and I don't know how to pronounce it, it's Barry Seed, it's B-A-R-R-E-S-E-I-D, from Chicago area. And there's a whole pattern of him giving to Heartland for years, and then through his foundation, at least back through 1999. But around 2005, he disappears. There's a funny thing in 2005, 2006, where a whole lot more money comes in, and then the next year it goes out to a bunch of different other nonprofits. Heartland had never done that before or afterwards. One of them was to a place called Scheimer College, and it turns out that there was a takeover attempt sort of run by Saeed with a new board, or attempting to have a new board, which was mostly people who worked for Saeed or people who were funded by Saeed. And then later, what happens is the money comes to Scheimer College through this donors trust, donors capital combination. And that entity also supplied a lot of money to Heartland. That's the big boost, came through donors. And so I can't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I would bet, you know, there's nobody else that fits. And in particular, the other possibilities were all named as named donors in the funding document, which says, you know, pretty unlikely.
Well, right. You found a lot of money that was named coming from the likes of Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, BP, Amoco, the Koch brothers, and even, surprise, surprise, the government-owned General Motors. Is this how the oil industry hides its attack on climate science?
Yeah, the way I would put it is, so you guys play a similar brand of football in Canada, and you know, what I put it is that the ExxonMobil especially got the play going and then did a handoff to the big family foundations. Now, of course, the Koch brothers are both big oil and foundation. But some of this, like Saeed, it seems to be pure ideology. They're willing to take up the cudgels for this. So the thing is, I think, you know, ExxonMobil Foundation sort of dropped out of this in the mid-2000s because they got a lot of criticism. Now, frankly, I was surprised that they ever did it through the foundation because the amounts are minuscule compared to their daily profits. Of course, you understand corporations can always donate directly. None of that showed up in this. So it may well be that they did a lot of seed funding starting especially around 1998. And that was, you know, there was a group put together by the American Petroleum Institute that was covered in one of my earlier reports, you know, with the head lobbyist, Randy Randall from ExxonMobil, and Fred Singer's wife, and the folks from Competitive Enterprise Institute, that whole gang. And it seemed like they got the ball rolling and then stepped back. Why not? If somebody else will go pay for it, the corporations don't spend money they don't need to.
And many of these groups, John, told the U.S. Internal Revenue Service that they don't do any lobbying of politicians. And is that true?
Well, let me distinguish two kinds of things that I particularly looked at in my big report. There's the kind of thing where you violate the rules for nonprofits by advocating all sorts of things that are not fact-based, that are sort of emotionally based, that tax on other people. Like, there were about 10 use of alarmist per issue of this climate news, right? There was like 880 mentions of alarmist. Now, lobbying is a grayer zone, and it's harder to prove because, after all, the best lobbying is sort of one-on-one kinds of things, right? But Heartland has a long history, and I showed a whole lot of examples where they brag about their access to legislators. They talk about the newsletters mostly going to legislators, state and local, across the country. They quote things where they say legislators changed their mind. You know, what percentage of them changed their mind as a result of reading their newsletters. They have these little dinners where they pay for government officials to come, and otherwise, they're for their big donors. Now, you know, would you guess that the big donors sit at separate tables from the legislators? Probably not, right? But, you know, they mention things where they give presentations to representatives, and they bring non-experts, but they claim they're experts. Anyway, that's a harder thing to prove. What was clear was their IRS forms always said that they did none of this. And, you know, nonprofits are allowed to do a certain amount of it, but they also have to say what money they spend and how much effort they do. And, you know, Heartland just continually bragged to its advertisers, to its donors, of how much access it had to state and local governments.
And where does your investigation go from here? Has the IRS responded in any way?
I haven't heard from them, but I wouldn't have expected to yet. It's only been a week, so. Now, you know, I sent them a note, appropriate note, and pointed them at this, I told them a report was coming because I sent this, you know, before it was up. And then I have since told them exactly where it was and mentioned the leaked material. But again, leaked material, I could have done perfectly well without it, but it was interesting to see that they inter-corroborated each other quite well.
Well, I don't want you to give away any secrets, but what still needs to be done to expose what looks to me like money laundering that goes through for climate denial and who pays for it all? What are you looking at next?
Oh, yeah. Well, so let me try. There were more things that were on my list to go look at, like tracking down where exactly the money was coming through that flowed through donors' trust. But in fact, you know, I found already things that look like four or five deep funding chains where the money moved around, right? And in particular, I noticed that there were a number of grants made to foreign entities that, in fact, were not charities. And that, by the way, is a serious no-no to the IRS. And there were two entities in Canada, one of which was not a charity, and there were two entities, well, sort of in New Zealand, although it sort of semi-migrated to Canada in a peculiar way. Then there were a bunch of unspecified things that went probably to Australia, maybe even to India. There's some dotted lines that connect things pretty well. Like for instance, Joanne Nova made this thing called the Skeptics Handbook, which is just, you know, ridiculous anti-science. And Heartland gave out 14,000 copies to school board presidents in the U.S. I don't know if any got up to Canada, but they were all over the U.S. They even mocked one of the presidents who rejected it kind of vocally. So there's a pretty strong dotted line there. Now, I can't find that out because, you know, it's material they don't have to make public, but the IRS knows. So we'll see.
All right. Well, as we wrap up, did I miss anything that you would like to add?
Well, I think just one thing here. One of the things I did in the report was to show a chart on page 3, I think it was, of the funders at the top who they funded amongst a group of about a dozen think tanks, and then how not just Heartland and Fred Singer's place and the Center for the Study of Carbon Dioxide and Global Change, but a bunch of other think tanks. And what you find is that in Heartland's documentation that they put out, you find people from those other think tanks often contributing ideas, wrong arguments typically, to the material Heartland puts out. Or they're part of Heartland's NIPCC reports or Heartland's global warming experts that are sent to legislators. So, you know, what you find is it's the same group funding all this stuff, and it's a bunch of nonprofits that manage to generate all this disinformation. And so part of the thing, I think, is to explore more of the money paths and what goes on. You know what these guys do, too, is I have this term fakesperts. They all quote each other back and forth or write articles, all quoting each other or using each other's stuff, all claiming each other are distinguished experts, right? And it's, you know, I know a lot of real experts, you know, members of the National Academy and folks like that. And I'm afraid none of these are real experts.
Well, there you have it. Like a kind of superhero for science, Dr. John Mashey tracks down the money trail and helps protect climate science, I think, and scientists. So, John, please keep me posted. Let's talk again.
We will, and I would just like to end. You know, I was up in British Columbia last April and had a terrific trip, thanks to PIX, and was glad to talk to you then and now.
All right, and you can find out more at dsmogblog.com. Dr. John Mashey is spelled M-A-S-H-E-Y. Do find out more. It's pretty interesting stuff. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Fossil fuel industries and anti-climate fanatics go further than funding fake charities and buying fake experts. They use big campaign donations to buy off governments as well. The governments then order their own scientists not to talk to the press or intervene with public relations agents to rewrite scientific conclusions. That is another reason why you hear so little about the massive threat climate change poses to us now and in all coming generations. The American Academy for the Advancement of Science is so concerned about attacks on climate science and scientists, they held a special session called Unmuzzling Government Scientists, How to Reopen the Discourse, in Vancouver on February 17, 2012. From that session, here is one of the few Canadian climate scientists willing and able to speak out, IPCC lead author and University of Victoria professor Dr. Andrew Weaver, quoting from a work of Canadian journalist Mike D'Souza.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government introduced new rules to control interviews with journalists by Environment Canada scientists in 2007 that resulted in an 80% drop in media coverage of climate change science, according to an internal analysis that was released in 2010.
That's right. Most Canadians can't even name three Canadian climate scientists. They've hardly heard from them. Canadian reporters have almost given up asking the government for interviews as Prime Minister Stephen Harper rams through the tar sands operations and the Alberta oil industry he represents. Here is a short talk from Canada's top climate science reporter, Margaret Munro, for Post Media. Then we'll get an update on the situation in the United States.
As Catherine mentioned, I've been a longtime scientist in Canada, and I've been able to witness this pretty remarkable change that's happened. We used to have a very open system of government where the scientists were actually free to discuss the research with the media. But it's now become a very closed system, with government taking media and message control to, in sometimes quite incredible extremes. And we're not talking about state secrets here. There have been several cases where the scientists have not been allowed to discuss studies that they've published in research journals. And I'm going to run through some examples. But before I tell you about how bad it's become in here in Canada, I want to tell you a bit about how good it used to be. There are thousands of government scientists, and they study everything from the Arctic ice to safety of food and medicines, and they basically do science in the public interest. And not so long ago, you could actually phone them up and talk to them. You know, you say you want to do a story on their work, and they were often often encouraged to actually do the interviews with the reporters. And, you know, it could happen quite quickly. You could phone them up, and within an hour, you'd be interviewing these people. It was quite an open system. And this is the kind of story, and attention they used to attract. So this story ran in the Times Colonist in February 2007. And those are four government scientists, with Andrew here is on the second from the left. The scientists were involved in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They were all authors, co-authors of it. And so we just wanted to do a story on the Canadian involvement in the IPCC. And I phoned them up, said it, told them the story we wanted to do. And they said, sure, come on over. I flew over. We interviewed them. Went down, took some pictures, came back. The story runs in the newspapers across the country. One of the interesting things about this story is that, as you can see, the federal scientist, like Ken Denman, who's quoted in the top there, he was not only allowed to talk about his science, but he felt free to actually give his own personal opinion that we have to act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, as I say, that was early 2007. By the end of the year, things had changed pretty dramatically. All of a sudden, when you'd phone a federal scientist, Environment Canada scientist, they'd either not call you back or they'd say, I can't talk to you. You've got to go through Ottawa now. We have had a change of policy. And invariably, you'd end up in the hands of one of these media handlers from Ottawa who would phone you back or send you an email and they'd say, okay, what's the story? They want the questions in writing. They'd say, submit your questions. And then invariably, they get back to you and say, oh, you can't talk to that person. And here's some, and they'd often give you scripted lines that, approved lines that you could use. So I started asking around, and because I thought, well, this is quite a big change. So I started asking around, and a source inside government leaked us this document here, which is laid out the new media protocol for the Environment Canada. As you can see, it's dated from November 2007, and it's several pages long, but I just brought up along a couple of key pages. So here's one that gives the rationale, and it says, just as we have one department, one website, we should have one department, one voice. Now, science sort of depends on debate and discussion, right? And if you only have one voice, you don't have a skeptical voice, and you don't have proper debate. So I have a bit of a problem with that, but my bigger problem is where this part of it is how it's going to work. It says, media relations at national headquarters will coordinate all the media calls coming into the department. So as a reporter who actually works in Vancouver, I find this a bit frustrating. Like, so if you don't make your call before 1 o'clock, you are waiting till the next day. But that's minor compared to the third point there, where it talks about how the program experts are going to respond with approved lines. Now, approved lines are laundered and scripted lines. And the program experts are actually the scientists. So basically, we've got the PR people now are telling the scientists and working with them. And like it's not like they seem to jump ahead of the scientists in terms of who's making the decisions here. So anyway, we did a big story on this, and it was front page news across the country. There was all kinds of editorials and outrage about the people saying, they shouldn't be muzzling the scientists. But basically, the government just sat out the controversy, and the policy stayed in force, for the most part, in Environment Canada. And it soon spread to other science-based departments. And no one has ever really explained, to my knowledge, the need for this policy. But it fits with other changes that the Harper government has made. This government has got a reputation for obsessive media and message control. The government now has like a small army of people crafting and vetting media lines and doing media strategy in Ottawa. There's apparently 4,459 information officers, media handlers, and strategists working for the federal government. And it's pretty clear that for federal scientists, Ottawa decides now if the researchers can talk, what they can talk about, and when they can say it. And when interviews are approved, they're often tape-recorded by minders in Ottawa, which has got to be, I think, pretty intimidating for some of these scientists because the government's in the midst of slapping budgets, and it really doesn't like people doing a lot of talking with the media. So it's not a good situation. And there's been lots of controversy about it over the last few years.
Radio EcoShock will be back in just a minute with more on the muzzling of Canadian climate scientists from journalist Margaret Monroe. Then we'll find out if it's any better in the United States. Stay tuned.